May it please the court?
Certainly.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Randall Brockman, and I represent the relator, Ms. Sharonda Tankins, in this case. And I want to start with probably the single most important concept in this case, and it's very, very critical that this concept is well understood, and that is that ever since 2004, when the U.S. Supreme Court decided Crawford v. Washington, confrontation and hearsay are separate. They are not the same. They are separate analyses, and this court has recognized that at least since 2007.
Of course, the context of the Crawford case is a criminal prosecution. So even if we accept all of your argument regarding what the interpretation or the application of Crawford is, how does that inform the issue before us? And that is, we have a probation revocation case.
Yes, so there's actually a couple of ways. The first is that I believe Crawford, while it was a criminal case, I believe it is broadly applicable. It's not limited to a criminal context. The second way is that the Crawford case defines the phrase the right to confront adverse witnesses, or the right of confrontation.
Do you agree that a probation revocation is a civil proceeding?
I agree that it is technically a civil proceeding with criminal consequences, and some courts have held that distinction to be important, and have held that because there are criminal consequences, certain aspects of criminal law apply. But we don't even need aspects of criminal law to apply, because the right to confront adverse witnesses is a phrase with a definition, and it means the same thing, no matter what the context. And there is no law that I am aware of in Missouri or anywhere else that says the right to confront adverse witnesses changes based on if it's a criminal case or a civil case or a probate case or
so
any kind of case.
So why not just go under hearsay then? You're saying it really means the same thing as the hearsay rule.
No, they're different. The right to confront adverse witnesses is the right to exclude testimonial out-of-court statements unless the declarant is unavailable and there has been a prior opportunity to cross-examine. Now, that's different from hearsay. Those are two separate analyses, and the fact that evidence might satisfy confrontation but be inadmissible hearsay, that's inadmissible evidence. And if evidence it falls under some hearsay exception but violates confrontation.
Doesn't that require the lawyer to make both objections if they apply?
Did
that occur in this case?
So in this case, I believe at trial, or at the hearing rather, Mr. Horneyer, Ms. Tankins' counsel, he only objected to hearsay for the reports and the testimony
so
based
then
on
the
reports.
The confrontational issues waived?
I believe it is not. And I believe it's not for because this is not a direct appeal. This is a writ, and so this court has broad discretion to do essentially as it pleases. And this issue was also raised from the beginning in this writ proceeding, from the very first application for writ in the Eastern District. Mr. Horneyer wrote that Ms. Tankins' confrontation rights were violated by the admission of this evidence. So this, this has been at issue for the entirety of this proceeding.
I understand it was raised at the appellate level, but don't you generally have to make your objection and then preserve your constitutional issue? I mean, you can waive a constitutional issue at trial, you can waive it post-trial.
That would be true if this were a direct appeal, but because it's a writ, this court has broader discretion, and this issue was not waived.
Although it's an extraordinary writ, and so we have very limited use of extraordinary writs.
I believe that extraordinary writs should be used only in extraordinary circumstances. Your Honor is correct. However, when using an extraordinary writ, this court has broad discretion. And I do believe this is an extraordinary circumstance because of the sheer number of constitutional violations that occurred here.
It gets to a point that really concerns me regarding this case. What if at the end of the day there is sufficient evidence of a probation violation here, but it's unknown to this court whether or not the sentencing court would have revoked the probation and imposed the sentence if only certain parts of this evidence was admissible as opposed to not all of it. Generally, in a writ proceeding, the remedy is either issue a writ or not issue a writ. But isn't this a rare case where if some of this evidence should have came in and some of it should have not come in, that the appropriate remedy would be to remand?
I believe so
that the trial court could, and upon remand, it would actually be a restart of the probation revocation proceedings.
Yes, that could be an appropriate remedy. This court could issue a writ of mandamus, requiring the respondent to a writ of prohibition prohibiting respondent from revoking Ms. Tankin's probation, and then also a writ of mandamus requiring him to have another hearing subject to this court's determination of what evidence should or should not have been admitted. But I believe in this case, none of the evidence that was adduced at the hearing was admissible.
What about when he exercised his right to remain silent? Why can't the court take a negative inference from that?
Sure. So there's a couple of reasons why not. Now, granted, this is a civil proceeding, and in a civil proceeding, generally, an adverse party may call another adverse party to the stand. However, there are a number of exceptions here. The first exception I want to talk about is that you cannot call a witness, any witness, to the stand for the sole purpose of having them invoke their Fifth Amendment privilege. That's true in a criminal case, and I believe that's true in a civil case as well. And even still...
So in this case, basic reporting requirements, couldn't a judge ask the defendant, did you fail to report? The answer to that question isn't calculated to lead to any incriminating evidence. It is calculated to lead to a question about whether or not the defendant complied with the terms of probation, but that isn't a separate crime. So all those things that are violations that aren't crimes, why isn't that fair game for the judge to ask the defendant?
Well, Judge, this is a separate exception. The exception I believe you're referring to is that no negative inference can be drawn from a witness's refusal to testify to answer incriminating questions. And the exception is not as limited as your question implies. It's not just, I can refuse to answer a question if it is, did you commit a crime? The exception is, I can refuse, and any witness can refuse to answer a question if the answer to that question will have criminal consequences. And saying, did you revoke this condition? That certainly, or did you violate this condition such that I can now revoke your probation? That has criminal consequences. And that's not me saying that. That's the United States Supreme Court saying that. In Hoffman v. United States, which I cited in my brief, it says, to sustain the privilege, it need only be evident from the implications of the question in the setting in which it is asked that a responsive answer to the question or an explanation of why it cannot be answered might be dangerous because injurious disclosure could result. Not disclosure that could subject the witness to separate criminal prosecution, but any injurious disclosure.
Is that just one phrase that and we're supposed to know it means that, or has that been taken up or elaborated or interpreted in other cases to mean it applies in situations like this or in probation revocation hearings?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
However, I think in the case of Padilla, there are a number of cases where the distinction between civil and criminal is not, quote-unquote, a technical violation. I mean, that people have been deported as a collateral consequence of a criminal action, and that's been held to be fine civilly, or they've been put on registry lists that could deny them employment for the rest of their lives as a collateral consequence to and that's determined that, well, that's not a criminal aspect and deserve the protections that you need in criminal cases.
And actually, Judge, there's another U.S. Supreme Court case that's on point here. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of it. I apologize. But it's Gastulum Quimenis, I believe. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that the defendant could not be deported based solely on the negative inference that he failed to present evidence. at his deportation hearing. And that court held that there was not enough evidence. The state did not put on enough evidence to deport him. And the judge in that case had relied on drawing a negative inference, and that was not allowed. That was not okay. And so in the deportation context, a negative inference is not enough to subject someone to civil consequences. And so in a probation revocation context, there's no way that a negative interest alone is enough to subject someone to criminal consequences.
But don't we have cases saying that a probation revocation has some quasi-criminal aspects, and in certain situations you would have the right to counsel or certain due process rights that you might not have in other civil proceedings? So is that part of the basis for your argument?
Yes, it is.
That here these protections should apply?
Yes, and those protections come from two United States Supreme Court cases, Morrissey and Gagnon. Morrissey details some due process protections that defendants in parole revocation hearings have, and Gagnon applies those to probation revocation.
What's required, in your view, what type of evidence is required to prove a failure to report?
In order to prove a failure to report?
Do you have to call the probation officer that you were to report to say that you did not show up?
Not necessarily.
Okay, then what type of evidence is permitted for that? That wouldn't violate your right to confrontation, wouldn't violate your right to remain silent.
Right, so in Morrissey, the Supreme Court said that probation or parole revocations, and then later Gagnon said probation revocation defendants, have a right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses absent a finding of good cause why confrontation should not be required. And so in this case, in a probation revocation failure to report, you would either have to have the probation officer come in and testify, this person failed to report to me on such and such date, or put on evidence about why confrontation should not be required and have the court make a finding of good cause on the record why confrontation should not be required. And then that officer's report would not violate the confrontation right.
So would good cause be, I've been transferred from St. Louis to Cape Girardeau, and it's inconvenient for me to show up?
It might be. It might not be. I don't know. This record is totally bare of any reason why someone with personal knowledge did not show up. And so in a future case, perhaps that's good enough. In this case, we don't even have that. And for those reasons, I'm asking.
Can you also address, I think you argued, even if there wasn't a confrontation issue, there were numerous hearsay issues and hearsay within hearsay?
Yes. So I'll address the broader hearsay issues first.
Very quickly.
Yeah. I do not believe that these reports qualified under the business records exception. No one has ever argued that Ms. Thomas, the probation officer who testified, was actually a custodian of these records. So we're working on other qualified witness. I believe she is not a qualified witness because she did not testify about these reports preparation specifically. She testified about how she does her own, but we don't know who the authors of these reports are. We don't know how they made their reports. We don't know what they did. And then further and more importantly, Ms. Thomas actually testified, as I put out in my brief, that these reports were not made at or near the time of the events. And that is a requirement under the business records statute. And since she testified, not only did she not testify that they were made there, she testified that they were not made at or near the time. So then they clearly do not fall under the exception.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The Hoffman case you cite for the principle that you can assert your Fifth Amendment right, and it doesn't have to be criminal consequences, it only has to be that the disclosure could be injurious. That's a 1951 case. What do you have since 1951, and how does that compare to the Supreme Court jurisprudence since 1951?
Yes, Judge. So I have a number of out-of-jurisdiction cases, first off, that I cite in my brief again, that specifically say, this is People v. Mansur, a case from Michigan from 1988, this fundamental privilege against compulsory self-incrimination accompanies a criminal defendant throughout the entire course of every criminal prosecution, including both sentencing and any subsequent probation revocation hearing. I have also Also, I have State v. Sidebottom, which is not directly that point, but that is a Missouri case from, I'm sorry, I forget the year, but I believe it's in the 80s.
88,
yeah. And that says that you cannot call a witness to the stand for the sole purpose of having them invoke their Fifth Amendment privilege. And that was the sole purpose here. First off, it was alleged in the pleadings, and it was never denied in the answer or return, and so this court must deem it admitted. But you can also tell from the record, from what the questions actually were, that the purpose here was to get the Fifth Amendment privilege
taken. About the United States versus Rappard case, where the court said a probationer cannot be compelled to testify against himself at a probation hearing when his testimony might incriminate him at a later criminal proceeding? I mean, the questions that are posed here clearly would not have any implication on any later criminal proceedings, and that seems to say just the opposite of what you've been trying to argue.
Now, Judge, I disagree with that, but my disagreement is not important because that is not a limitation. The Rapper Court did not say that the Fifth Amendment privilege only applies to later prosecutions. It says it also applies to later prosecutions, and that, I believe, is the plain words. Only is not there.
But also, some of these questions had to do with marijuana use and things, so some of the questions could have provided a basis for later criminal prosecution.
Yes, I agree with that. I believe they all could have. And so, I'm sorry?
Your time is up.
Thank you, Judge.
Are there other questions? We'll hear from you on rebuttal.
All right.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. Again, Chris Farber for Respondent. I'm going to start kind of where opposing counsel left off as far as the Fifth Amendment and the sole purpose of calling Ms. Tagus to the stand being for her to take the Fifth. That is not the case. I referenced the Court to Henry Berg, a 2011 case. It is also a civil proceeding. It is a SVP, or sexually violent predator, proceeding. And that states that the rule applies to jury trials. This was not a jury trial. That was. Additionally,
sure, it could be incriminating in front of the jury to have someone take the Fifth, whereas it's in front of the judge can weigh it.
Pardon?
In front of a jury, it could be incriminating to the
yes.
jury, but in front of a judge, the judge says what's going
yes, on. It could be prejudicial to see that in front of a jury, whereas a neutral arbitrator, such as a judge, can remove that in making a decision. Additionally, in Henry Berg, what the court wrote was that there need, when it came to authenticating the letter, where he made some admissions, all it takes is a question to have purpose beyond automatically triggering the Fifth. As your honors have pointed out, the line of questioning that Ms. Tankins faced was not in any way something that would implicate her in a future criminal proceeding.
Well, some of them were and some of them weren't.
Your Honor, I assume you're referring to the drug
that would be
questions.
What I'm referring to.
Without the corpus or the drugs themselves await an analysis of the corpus, the drugs themselves, she would not be able to be prosecuted. She could admit.
But does it have to be sufficient to have you convicted or simply be incriminated?
Well, I believe the two go hand in hand. We wouldn't be able to ethically
to,
issue.
Does it have to concede every element of a cause of action, or does it just have to be incriminating, is what I'm asking. You're saying you might need other things, too, but if you said I use marijuana, one could go try to find those other ones. Have you seen a case that says you have to admit every element of a criminal conviction in order for it to be incriminating?
I believe as a prosecutor, ethically, I would need to meet every element and have evidence
before you prosecute.
Before I
but
prosecute.
The question here is it incriminating to ask if they use marijuana?
I do not believe so, no.
Okay.
I don't think you can pick and choose and say, well, I'll answer that question or I won't answer that question. Once you take the stand and you start answering questions, I think you've got your problem. The defendant has his problems about then taking the Fifth Amendment.
Yes. But also referring back to Henry Berg, all it takes is one question that serves a purpose. And that would be one of the questions that would not be a proper invocation of her Fifth Amendment privilege, any of them. Reporting, payment of fees, things along those lines. And speaking of reporting, something that I do not believe anyone can deny that would not lead to a future criminal proceeding.
I guess my major concern in this case, assume for sake of argument that Lynn Diaz versus Massachusetts suggests that a probation violation report could never constitute a business record for purposes of hearsay. How can this case be appropriately resolved if some evidence came in that was admissible and some was not, other than a remand for a complete probation revocation hearing? In other words, to dial the clock back to zero, have another hearing, determine what evidence comes in, doesn't come in, and then the court decide whether or not the court would revoke probation or not.
Well, ultimately, relator has to show prejudice.
Well, I understand, but we've yet to hold a probation revocation hearing in this court, at least since I've been here, 8 years, and it really somewhat ill-designed to handle an original proceeding like that. I mean, the only reason this is here is a writ, because it's the only way to test the probation revocation proceedings. But what is the appropriate remedy if some evidence was admissible and some was not?
If some was admissible, I believe the appropriate remedy would be to deny the writ. So I guess not really a remedy.
Well, how do we know then? How do we know that this court then would have revoked the probation if that's the only factual finding they made? How do we know that if it wouldn't have just been reporting violations, that the court wouldn't have continued the probation?
Well, admittedly, the order lists every violation and does not pick a specific one.
Well,
I do not believe that any judge, Judge Brawley, being a judge, needed to pick a specific one.
I absolutely 100% agree with you. But how do we know that the court would have revoked probation if that's all they found?
Considering the broad discretion the court had, Judge Frawley had, he could exercise that discretion if there were some validly proven violations and some not.
Yes.
So Judge Fisher's saying, why should we assume he would revoke probation if not all of the violations were properly proven?
First off, he did revoke her probation, very obviously.
Well, assuming that he could admit all that evidence and find all those violations.
I mean, outside of a specific finding by the judge, I do not believe we can make any assumptions.
Okay, I agree. So also, it's not a double jeopardy issue. So if this case goes back for further proceedings, why doesn't it restart the clock and have a full hearing on everything that's contained in the probation violation report and the motion to revoke?
I believe if your honors do send the case back, that likely would be the situation, where the clock is reset.
Well, the other thing, following up on my junior judge, is that he said 8 years. My junior judge mentioned the issue of we have an obligation to protect the courts from testimony or evidence that's not really verified. That's why we have the hearsay rule.
Yes.
I mean, and as a trial lawyer, I always look to think, how can I get this evidence in legitimately? And the idea of failure to appear for a revocation, it may be easier to ask the person, say, did you appear or didn't appear? That's the easy way, but that's not necessarily the best way to proceed. Bring in the records or bring in people to say, you're supposed to be here, she was supposed to be here, and she wasn't. That shows failure to appear versus having to ask the witness, well, were you there or not there? There are other ways of getting the testimony in besides asking the the probationer, were you there or not there? And a trial lawyer always looks and says, what are other alternatives to get this in that wouldn't violate the hearsay rule?
Well, in the case at hand, the probation reports were admitted under the business records rule. And the plain language of cases that deal
with... But the business records requires you to have a... What your opponent mentioned, the business records requires certain requirements to get something in on business records. In fact, we in a case we had, or a civil case, we said 491, they didn't have it was robo signing. They really didn't have the contract. You couldn't pursue it because it wasn't then a business record under the business record rules.
Your Honor, under Jamestown Homeowners Association v. Jackson, a 2013 case out of the Missouri Court of Appeals, Eastern District, what is needed, what was written in that opinion, is a witness with sufficient knowledge of business operation and methods of record keeping. The record, in the case at hand, Ms. Thomas was asked about the creation of the probation.
But the records had to be contemporaneous with the event. They had to come in and business records also.
You can't just know generally how it's done. You have to know about these records. That's what we've held more recently in a consumer case.
I think is even a bigger problem for you. What about the Melendez versus Massachusetts case?
Pardon?
I mean, everybody agrees a probation violation report is prepared for the purpose of court proceedings, correct?
It is, however.
So doesn't that automatically disqualify it from the business records exception?
The statute governing probation reports also says that they should be prepared generally. Probation reports can also reflect a completion of one of the conditions. It can just be an update, no status change whatsoever. It can reflect that some payments have been made on restitution, which in the case at hand, there was restitution payments and fees that were supposed to be paid where no payments were ever made.
The purpose of the report is to provide the court information so the court can decide whether or not to revoke probation or not, right?
That can be one use of the report.
But what if the court disagrees with your argument that these are business records and qualify for that exception? What is the result then in this case?
The result then, I believe this court can take a look at Ms. Tankin's testimony and again improperly invoking her Fifth Amendment privilege on many of the questions, I would contend all of the questions.
So is the court's negative inference enough on that? Is that enough?
I believe it is.
Why?
In conjunction with the business records.
Well, let's say the business records
are not
admitted. We find they should not have been admitted. Then all we have left is a negative inference from the court. Is that enough?
Yeah, in my opinion, yes.
Is there a court that's agreed with that you can cite to us?
I would point the court to In re Monning, where there was a child who was being homeschooled by his parents, and the court there wrote that the court can make an adverse inference as it's a civil proceeding, and the underlying evidence there was that the caseworker came into the home, was not an expert on education or educational standards. It was just a caseworker. But the adverse inference was made. The crux of that opinion, it did not terminate their parental rights or remove the children from the home. But the dicta in that case alluded to, this is going back because there's no expert witness here. There's nothing. And in and of itself, them taking the Fifth was not wide enough as far as the breadth of questioning.
Can you address Morrissey and Gagnon? And we have cases which we've decided that probation revocation hearings are quasi-criminal or sufficiently complex. You have a right to counsel. Opposing counsel cites cases saying you have a right to confront your witnesses and cross-examine adverse witnesses. And you have other due process rights that you would not necessarily have in a civil case, but you do because of the quasi-criminal nature of probation revocation proceedings?
Cases Gagnon and Morrissey v. Brewer, they were very clear that in a probation revocation hearing that the minimum requirements of due process apply, not the Sixth Amendment.
Do they talk about cross-examination and adverse witnesses?
They do mention it, but under the umbrella of due process.
Okay, so how about here, under the umbrella of due process? Is that applicable?
I believe so. I would point the court, well, first off, in Scarpelli and Brewer, no witness was called. And that laid the foundation for how probation revocation hearings would be held 44 years ago, as long as I've been on this earth. As recently as 2015, however, in U.S. v. Boyd, an Eighth Circuit decision, admittedly not controlling, but certainly persuasive, the probation officer, Hudson, in that case, had the probationer for about as long as Ms. Thomas had Ms. Tankins, a month. The previous probation officer had retired.
Now, getting to the present beyond 44 years ago, if we issued the writ to start over or take some of the, what you would think the writ should say if we issued it? Just start over?
I believe just start over, the whole ball of wax.
Thank you.
Go on.
What, go ahead and tell us about the Eighth Circuit case you were just about to talk.
Oh, in that probation officer, I believe it's Jay Hudson, he shows up to court, again, has about as much experience with his probationer as Ms. Thomas had with Ms. Tankins, had the probation report. It was prepared in the same course of business, in the same way we have here. There are standards to the procedures of preparing probation reports, both federally and in the state of Missouri. And the court found, because courts are afforded broad discretion, that is plain language that is used over and over in both federal and Missouri cases when addressing the situation, used its broad discretion in finding them to be admissible under business records, which it did. And it differentiated some other cases, such as U.S. v. Johnson, where a probation report reflected earlier police reports, a separate agency. So,
does this address my question about Morrissey and the right to confront adverse witnesses?
Pardon?
That right to confront adverse witnesses under Morrissey and Gagnon?
Ms. Tankins was afforded an adverse witness to confront, and Mr. Horneyer, her attorney, did cross-examine Ms. Thomas.
And though they didn't have personal knowledge, the Eighth Circuit found that the business records exception applied.
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
So what kind of a writ would us issue a writ to start over or start in the middle? What would you like us to do?
Judge, I would like this court to issue a writ of prohibition prohibiting Judge Frawley from revoking Ms. Tankins' probation and from sentencing her
and ordering her back on probation.
Yeah,
how would you be entitled to that if there is one violation that is demonstrated by admissible evidence?
Because there is no violation that's demonstrated by admissible evidence.
I understand that's your view. But if there's sufficient evidence as to one violation, why wouldn't the appropriate remedy to go back, number one, and see what the judge would do on that? But on number two, why aren't all of your clients' constitutional rights protected by remanding for a new proceeding?
Because in this case, that would be allowing the state two bites at the apple.
Well, there's no double jeopardy for probation violation, right?
I agree that there's no double jeopardy, but there is an issue of fundamental fairness. The state had its chance. The state offered no excuse why someone with personal knowledge didn't come testify. And actually, Mr. Farber was just talking about Boyd, in that case, there was a finding of good cause why the right probation officer didn't have to come and why confrontation should not be allowed. And so that's very clearly distinguishable.
So what I hear you saying then is if we found there was some evidence, they shouldn't get a chance to redo it and do it right in any trial. We don't send it back and say you messed up and the evidence wasn't admissible, we'll give you a do-over. But why wouldn't they get to remand for the Judge Frawley or whoever heard the case to decide whether what the evidence that was properly admissible, if we found there was some, was sufficient to revoke probation?
Well, because I think there is no way that this court could find that. If this court did find that, then I see no legal reason why that would not be appropriate with instructions to disregard the inadmissible evidence and potentially prevent the state from trying to reintroduce the inadmissible evidence unless they somehow fixed.
When we rule on a case where evidence has been admitted that was improperly admitted, we grant a new trial. We don't send it back for them to try and figure out what they would decide. So when in fact there is an improper admission of evidence, the result isn't that you figure out what you would have done if that evidence had been out. It's for a rehearing or a retrial, isn't it?
I guess my confusion, I think, and this problem is stemming from, I'm not actually sure that your remedy and my remedy are different. Because you're
suggesting that they only had one time in one proceeding to call and present competent evidence. And what Judge Breckenridge's question suggests is that normally you're entitled to have your constitutional rights protected. If the evidence was inadmissible, we hit the restart button to make sure that they're protected. Not that you have a right to keep out admissible evidence on a retrial.
Right. And I think even under my proposed remedy, the state could reinitiate these proceedings. So the only difference I'm seeing between my proposed remedy and the court's is who is deciding whether or not this probation violation hearing will be held. Is this court ordering it to be reheld, or is this court leaving it to the state's discretion whether the state thinks that it can get competent evidence to rehear it? And I think in the interest of judicial efficiency, that should be the state's decision.
But this is the posture of this case, the writ.
Yes.
It's not like a trial after appeal, and it's not a final, it's a writ, not a trial.
I agree, and that if for my remedy, this court just needs to issue a writ of prohibition prohibiting respondent from revoking Ms. Tankin's probation and sentencing her based on this hearing that was held. For the court's remedy, I believe the court would need to issue a writ of prohibition prohibiting Judge Frawley from doing that, and in addition, a writ of mandamus requiring Judge Frawley to hold another probation revocation hearing. And so my remedy is also simpler for this court.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.
Thank you.